Through adversity comes opportunity. That is my life lesson. Through adversity comes opportunity. All of us have a backstory. All of us have a pain to purpose story, but it's realizing, like, take something that really wasn't so ideal and turn it, like, reframe it. Just say, okay, this is part of my story, but it's not who I am. This is part of my story, but it is not what defines me. And so I think that's really important for people because, like I said, each one of us probably have a journey of adversity to opportunity. And it, so much of it's just like, I always tell my kids, I'm just looking forward. I'm just looking forward. Like, what's, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Terrible analogy to use in this context. But the point is, like, if you can't do anything else, just take one step forward.
Welcome to Your Health Reset, where we address the real root causes behind health issues today to get you rapid results on your health journey so you can be who you came here to be, mind, body, and spirit. I'm your host, Sinclair Keneally, survivor of complex chronic illness, expert on resolving root causes, and co-founder of Detox Rejuvenation and Meditation RX. Let's get started. Welcome back to another episode of Your Health Reset. And today I am joined by my wonderful friend, Cynthia Thurlow. She is a force of nature in the functional medicine space. As a nurse practitioner and a two-time TEDx speaker whose talks have been viewed millions of times and a multi-time best-selling author, she is now sharing with us her brand new book on intermittent fasting for women. And she is such a passionate advocate for midlife women's health that I think you'll really enjoy this and all the myth busting that we do about intermittent fasting and health for women. Enjoy. Welcome to another interview with me, your host, Sinclair Keneally, and I am joined by my lovely friend, Cynthia Thurlow, today. It's so fun to have you on here. Welcome, Cynthia.
I've been really looking forward to this. Always a pleasure to connect with you and your community.
Oh, thank you. And you have such an exciting book coming out, and I really want to dive into some of the gems in it today. But let's start zoomed out and help connect the dots for people, because obviously we're talking about chronic digestive issues throughout the summit and the root causes for how does our gut actually get out of whack? And what does it take for people to take control of their own health journey back into their own hands so that they can get all the way healthy and vibrant again?
Well, I mean, the irony is this is something that I speak on so frequently because as a culture, you know, here we are, this beautifully westernized culture, and we are hedonistic. We have access to everything and anything 24/7. And along with that has come this highly processed, hyper palatable food industry, which has also given us the conjectures that we have to be eating frequently. We're telling our patients 3 meals a day plus snacks. We tell our patients that they need to stoke their metabolism. We talk about heart healthy grains. And what I've come to find over the last 20 years of working with patients is that we eat way too frequently. We eat the wrong foods. We're too stressed out. We don't slow down. And all of these things really impact the gut microbiome in profound ways. And I'll give you one example. So if we are eating frequently, we're not giving our body an opportunity to properly digest our food. There's actually a really cool system called the migrating motor complex that's in the gut. And it takes about 4 to 5 hours in between meals for our body to properly detoxify, digest, move this food forward. And if we're eating with tremendous meal frequencies, if we're eating every 2 to 3 hours, we completely obliterate the migrating motor complex's ability to properly function. And what I find for many individuals is that they're never giving their body an opportunity to digest their food. So they have chronically elevated blood glucose levels. Their insulin levels are never lower. Insulin levels need to be low in order to tap into fat stores for energy. So if you look at it as we're driving around with a full tank of gas and we keep topping it off. And so we never get an opportunity to really utilize the fuel that our body innately has. And most of us have plenty of extra fuel, right? Over this, you know, years of eating too frequently. So first and foremost, we're not giving our bodies an opportunity to properly break down and digest our food. We're dealing with this blood sugar dysregulation, which I think is at the basis for most, if not all, of the cravings for certain types of food, energy slumps that we get throughout the day, the feeling like we need to take a nap after a meal. I always say that's a first sign that you're definitely not fueling your body properly. And it really starts this cascade of metabolic disease. You know, it starts with a little degree of blood sugar dysregulation, which begets insulin resistance, which begets, you know, moving on to having you know, elevated blood pressure, you know, your lipids look abnormal. Maybe if you're trying to get pregnant, you're dealing with infertility issues. Maybe you've been told you're polycystic ovarian, you know, you're not ovulating. You've got a luteal phase defect. It makes you predisposed to developing certain types of cancers. And so I would be the first person to recognize that meal frequency is a huge impediment to our health. And if but nothing else, you know, the concept of eating less often, even if you're not comfortable with the word fasting, I've started to use this phrase, eat less often, because none of us should be snacking. None of us. Snacking is a sign that you didn't put your macros together properly. And macros are protein, fat, and carbohydrates. We're under eating protein and we're overeating the wrong types of carbohydrates. So it's the meal frequency, it's the choice of macronutrients that we're consuming that are further exacerbating this problem. And to give you a really good example, protein is the most satiating macronutrient that we can consume. And if we're under eating protein, we're opening up the possibility that we're not going to be satiated. And when we're not satiated, we're not going to crave broccoli. We're going to look for those hyper palatable, highly processed foods, which, you know, largely are a byproduct of subsidized crops. So you're getting a lot of genetically modified ingredients. You're getting the nasty seed oils, which I speak out about. If you do nothing else, try to avoid seed oils, things like corn oil, sunflower oil, safflower, soybean, the number one consumed seed oil in the United States, the number one consumed fat in the United States right now is soybean oil. So if you do nothing else, just read your food labels. Isn't that astounding?
Yeah, that's really scary when you think about how soy is actually grown and processed in this country.
Yes. I actually had the opportunity to connect with Jeffrey Smith, who's this GMO expert. And after listening to him, I'm a pretty prodigious food label reader, but now I'm even more conscientious after listening to him. So really being conscientious about the macronutrients we're consuming, not only will it help keep that blood sugar stable, but it's going to feed and nourish that gut microbiome. I remind people that really, we want to be focused on nutrient density. So, you know, being conscientious about those inflammatory foods, and for each one of us, that could be very, very different. Sometimes it's the focus on gluten and grains and dairy, soy and processed sugar, sometimes alcohol, but it's really very bio-individual and it requires a bit of experimentation to determine what foods are not working for you. But the inflammatory foods can also disrupt the gut microbiome. So meal frequency, types of foods that you're consuming, you know, really looking at the inflammatory foods and how they impact the gut microbiome. And then something that's so simple that people don't realize, you know, when I ask adults, when I ask children, where does digestion start? What do I hear? Everyone says your mouth. And I remind them it really starts in your brain. So we have two sides of the autonomic nervous system and really explaining that we have to be in the parasympathetic, the rest and repose side of our brains. And if we're not, we're not going to be able to properly detoxify, break down our foods, digest it, because we have these two sides, the parasympathetic and sympathetic. They're designed to be balanced. But when our body is in the sympathetic nervous system, we're in fight or flight. And unfortunately, we live in a society that, as I mentioned, hedonistic. We can be up all day, be up all night, eat all day, eat all night. But what that's doing is our body doesn't recognize being chased by a wild animal, doesn't differentiate that from being stuck in traffic, being irritated with a spouse or maybe someone, a coworker or your kids, doesn't differentiate. And so most of us are eating on the go. We're eating while standing up. We're, you know, not in a position where we're able to actually joyfully accept that food, nourish it, chew it, enjoy it, swallow it. And so if you're stuck in this sympathetic drive, that's also going to put a stress on the gut microbiome. You know, if cortisol is up in response to being in the sympathetic nervous system, you're going to open up those tight junctions in the small intestine. You're going to make yourself more susceptible to this small intestine hyperpermeability or leaky gut, the layman's term. And so it's really this domino effect. And I, even interestingly enough, I was listening to a lecture yesterday talking about just even the impact of our hormone, our sex hormones being properly balanced, that both estrogen and progesterone have direct impact on the enterocytes in the gut. And if they're not properly balanced, it can actually make you more prone to be more susceptible to gut infections or just systemic infections in general. So there's so many little pieces, little nuggets that all fit together in terms of what is adversely impacting the gut microbiome and ultimately our health.
I think that's one of the best, that may be the best overview I've ever heard for what has gone wrong for us as a culture and why have we seen this explosion. of distress in the gut and by extension, inflammatory conditions that then develop into chronic disease.
Yeah.
Right. And for the people listening, you know, in on this summit, you know, some of us or some of them are in more on the beginning of their journey. Like, wait a minute, I think I'm actually going to have to take control of my own health because my practitioners are not getting the job done. Mm-hmm. Oh, I might be in charge. And then we also have our wonderful summit junkies who are just looking for that next gem to get them just that little bit further because they're so dedicated to reclaiming their vitality. So I want to speak to both of them today in our talk. And one of the reasons why I'm so excited about your book is because, you know, intermittent fasting has been held up by the biohacking community for, you know, a few years now as like this amazing tool to help you unhook from these inflammatory habits that we have and perhaps these, as well, these inflammatory food choices that are so readily available to us, as you point out. And because women are more complex, their needs when it comes to using intermittent fasting as a tool or even eating less often, if we're going to be, you know, open it up to a spectrum, you know, women are more complex when it comes to their digestive, their metabolic and their, you know, hormonal and reproductive needs. So I'm so excited to dive into that with you today as well. I think that I want to start there actually. What makes it different for women? Because I know for myself, I was deciding like, oh, this isn't possible for me early in my journey when I was still in the throes of like mold and fibromyalgia and Lyme. I was eating a little bit of carbs every 2 hours. Otherwise, the nausea would just take over. It's like, I'm too fragile to even consider intermittent fasting. That's for, you know, the biohacking bros. That's not for me. So what would you say to that?
Well, I will be the first person to say that hormetic stress, whether it comes from fasting or high intensity interval training or cryotherapy or infrared sauna or, you know, specific types of foods that can upregulate some specific properties that go along with fasting, it's the right amount of stress at the right time in the right amount. And it's critically important if your body is under an assault, if you've been hospitalized, you're dealing with a chronic illness. A chronic illness that really has an acute component to it, you know, acute on top of chronic illness. You're going through a divorce, you're going through a move, you're in the midst of a global pandemic and you're dealing with a lot of extra stress and it just isn't the right time. So I think there are times when it is not at all appropriate to add in that additional stressor. Now, I think the other piece of it is really examining what's your sleep quality like. This is irrespective of gender. If your sleep is terrible, if you're getting less than 7 to 8 hours a night of high quality sleep, if your stress, as I mentioned, is out of control, if you're over-exercising, and how many women in particular do a really crummy job with this? They think if a little exercise is great, a lot more exercise is better. You know, I think about the CrossFit community. I'm just going to pick on them just for a second, but it's more intense exercise, right? And for some women at the life stage they're in, that's not the right type of exercise. The other piece is nutrition. And we've already kind of touched on that, but really figuring out for you, what is the right, you know, nutritional paradigm? And it could be very different for every person that's watching. It might be that you're carnivore-ish right now. It might be that you go through a period of being plant-based, or maybe you are doing a ketogenic diet for a short period of time. I think women in particular have to be mindful of going too low carb or too ketogenic, or sometimes not doing ketogenic properly, but really looking at nutrient density. That's ultimately my big focus, is making sure people properly understand that. But I agree wholeheartedly that women in particular, it's a little more challenging. I would say a postmenopausal woman and a man have a little bit more stability to the overall to their hormones than women at peak fertility years or women in perimenopause. And so there's no one size fits all for women. We really have to lean into our physiology and really understand that what makes us unique and beautifully unique is that we have this, you know, cascade of hormones, this orchestration of hormones throughout our menstrual cycle, and recognizing that at certain points in our cycle, it's advantageous to fast, and at other points, it is not. I'm not a fan of women fasting while they're breastfeeding or pregnant, and there's a lot of epigenetic research to suggest that can be potentially harmful. And so that's a platform I feel very comfortable standing on, along with a lot of other physician researchers, but really looking at fasting or eating less often is a beneficial stress to the body, but it has to be at the right time. And I think it's always helpful for full transparency. I've been on my own health journey for the last 3 years. In 2019, I spent 13 days in the hospital. And why this is relevant, 13 days where I was not able to eat and I was getting fed nutrition for 7 of those days by a bag, which is a whole separate conversation. But I did not fast for months afterwards because I had lost so much weight. I was so debilitated and my blood sugar was such a mess that I couldn't do it. And that's okay. Like anyone that's watching, if you've had to take a break, it is completely appropriate under specific circumstances to say, I need to take a break from this particular hormetic stress. And it could be for you, it's fasting. For someone else, it might be high intensity interval training. But just acknowledging that we are, you know, we're designed to not be the same day to day, and we may need something different throughout the month, throughout the year.
This is such a good point to make. And so, and it really is a balancing act when we're trying to heal, right? Because anytime we activate the digestive process, you're essentially distracting the body from doing other repair work, right? And so when we're trying to heal from a chronic condition, we want to be really mindful about our eating window, but balance that so we're not creating too much distress with too big of gaps in eating and yet still giving our body time to do the rest and repair side and not just spend all day long digesting or attempting to, you know, a little bit at a time.
No, and I think for a lot of people, they've gotten so comfortable or so disconnected from their bodies that they don't even realize that they don't feel good. They're bloated all the time. They have digestive distress, whether it's diarrhea or constipation. Someone said to me the other day that they look 8 months pregnant before they go to bed and they're not pregnant.
Yeah.
And so I said, that's not normal. It's not normal to not poop every day. It's not normal to have diarrhea every day. And so just acknowledging that if you're having a lot of reflux, you're having a lot of food intolerances, if you're feeling like specific foods, you know, give you indigestion or exacerbate the symptoms that I've alluded to, it can be a sign that there's something else that's going on. And so really being your own best advocate, as you've already said, ensuring that you get the answers that you need. From the perspective of acute or emergent medicine, we did a great job. We know exactly how to stabilize someone. We know exactly how to do an emergent surgery. We don't do such a great job with prevention and certainly not with chronic disease management. And so we have to be our own best detectives. We have to be our own best advocates. And that's what I love, you know, your platform where you're exposing all these amazing people that are watching to all these experts that can share insights into what they've learned over 10, 20 years of their careers. And I would suggest for anyone that's watching, I used to always tell my patients when I was working in cardiology, I may not know the answer, but I'm going to find someone that does. And so just never feeling like there isn't hope and acknowledging that this journey, it's meant to be a marathon. It's not meant to be a race. You know, we as a culture want everything instantaneously. We want everything to be better tomorrow. That's not realistic. And just to kind of prepare ourselves that the journey is a journey for a reason. You know, everything that we go through, everything that you've gone through has kind of spurned your own, you know, ability to share and serve others. And so I think most, if not all of us, have pretty good backstories to share.
Yeah, I think you're so right. And one of the things that I think is so important about doing summits like this is you get to hear from a variety of experts and also people learn through stories. You know, I think your story is amazing, how you still managed to take care of your family. And oh my God, your whole TED Talk story. You guys have got to watch Cynthia's TED Talks because they're phenomenal.
Oh, thank you.
They cause quite the sensation, and doing that while going through a health journey at the same time. And I think it's really revealing. And also reassuring that you gave yourself a break from fasting while you recovered from that.
Yeah. Oh, I had to. I remember walking through the hospital. So 13 days in the hospital, and my mom, my Italian mother, had to come with me to the hospital every time I had to go back to see if they could pull this drain out of my abdomen because I had a fistula. And I, being stubborn, I was like, no, I don't need a wheelchair to walk from, you know, being dropped off to the radiology area. And I'm walking down the hallway and I'm realizing I'm getting dizzy and I'm getting sweaty. And I'm realizing, oh my gosh, my blood sugar's low, but I haven't ever really experienced this in my whole life. And so I sat down, kind of coached myself through it. And the nurse came over and said, are you okay? And I was like, oh, I feel good. But just the acknowledgement that it is such a journey and perseverance. I would be the first person to say that through adversity comes opportunity. That is my life lesson. Through adversity comes opportunity. All of us have a backstory. All of us have a pain to purpose story, but it's realizing like take something that really wasn't so ideal and turn it, like reframe it to say, okay, this is part of my story, but it's not who I am. This is part of my story, but it is not what defines me. And so I think that's really important for people because, like I said, each one of us probably have a journey of adversity to opportunity. And it, so much of it's just like, I always tell my kids, I'm just looking forward. I'm just looking forward. Like what's, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Terrible analogy to use in this context. But the point is like, if you can't do anything else, just take one step forward.
I totally agree. So I would love to take some of our remaining time together to do a little bit of myth busting. The first one that I want to tackle is a particular pet peeve of mine, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. I cannot stand the life coaches and Instagram celebrities talking about just eat intuitively, just like whatever your body wants, whenever your body wants, when we have consistently and pretty much systematically trained ourselves away from real food over the last several decades so that we've actually completely disrupted that feedback loop. Mm-hmm. You know, in our bodies of what does our body actually need next? So what would you say to those people that are like, I don't know how to eat intuitively because what I crave is carbs and I feel fragile. And, you know, what are you talking about? Eat intuitively.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because I literally just had a conversation about this. You can't eat intuitively when you're metabolically inflexible. I'm going to say this again. You cannot eat intuitively if your hormones are not properly balanced because hormones are what drive a lot of the choices that we make. And I'll give one example. We have these two hormones called leptin and ghrelin. And when they're not properly regulated, not only do we not feel satiated, but we can't shut off our hunger cues. And so if I were to say to someone who is maybe insulin resistant, maybe they've got 20 pounds to lose, maybe they've dealt with a tick-borne illness, maybe they've been exposed to mold and they're genetically susceptible to that. So, you know, they're part of that 20% of the population that's more susceptible.
Thank you for mentioning that.
And their leptin is off the charts, you know, they're leptin resistant. Saying that to them is almost harmful because it's not acknowledging their own bio-individuality. And so I will oftentimes say the way that we choose to become metabolically flexible involves changing the way that we're eating, but also our relationship with food. When you're metabolically flexible, you can intuitively eat because your body says, okay, I'm full and I'm going to crave the broccoli and I'm going to have the chicken and then I'm going to have a little bit of rice and I'm done. When you're not metabolically healthy, your body's going to say, I don't want the chicken. I definitely don't want the broccoli. I want all the rice. I want a lot of rice. I want a big bowl of rice. I don't want a lot of protein. So your brain, there's a disconnect between your brain and your stomach. But there's also like the satiety cues are completely dysregulated. So it's also the same group of people that will say things like, if it fits your macros, and they'll sit there and eat like 6 Krispy Kreme donuts because it's a higher carb day. So I think it really does people a disservice to recognize that today you might not be able to intuitively, but that can change. And that's over time. And sometimes you've never learned those cues because you've been eating with meal frequency and making food choices that have completely disrupted the brain chemistry, the communication chemistry, the hormonal symphony that should be going on in your body as a hormonal strike. And so you first have to harness making sure you get the hormones better balanced. And there's a lot to it, but it's not as complicated as it sounds. And then you can lean into your body and say, okay, what is my body telling me? But until that time happens, you're not in a position to be able to properly heal. And I would even argue that it does people a disservice because it creates this kind of negative mindset. And people are constantly beating themselves up, like, what's wrong with me? Why doesn't this right. work? Why can't I intuitively eat? Then they eat more because then they're stressed. Then it's comfort eating. And then it just kind of begets all these other, it's like a domino effect. So give yourself a timeout if you're not in a position where you're metabolically well, and work slowly towards metabolic flexibility. And, you know, we can obviously unpack more of that. And then you'll be in a position, but you have to be metabolically healthy to be able to intuitively eat.
Completely agree with you. I'm so glad you said that. So let's unpack the elements of metabolic flexibility. And what should people be looking for and aiming towards?
Yeah. So I usually start with what defines metabolic syndrome. And so here in the United States, it looks at waist circumference. So for men, if your waist is greater than 45 inches, for women, greater than 35. So you can get a tape measure out and you can measure that pretty easily. It's looking at your blood pressure. So if your blood pressure is high, most recent estimations, because the numbers have changed so much over 20 years, it's like 130 over 90 or above, you know, really looking to see if you're a little, got this prone to insulin resistance. It's looking at, so they oftentimes look at fasting glucose, but what I think is more important is fasting insulin. So fasting insulin, more often than not, is dysregulated first prior to fasting glucose. Also looking at your lipids, and it's not total cholesterol. I know a lot of people like to look at that, but I do find your fasting triglycerides, I like to see them pretty low, like under 75, but they'll make the argument sometimes if they're under 150, you want them under 150, I would argue we want them lower because it's very often correlated with the carbohydrate consumption. For a long time, they really wanted to look at HDL, which was considered to be the heart healthy cholesterol.
Right.
And so if it's low, it can be pathogenic. And so for men, you want it greater than 45, women, you want it greater than 55. There's some genetic susceptibility, but I think that's a good starting point for objectively looking at data. But it's also looking at like, what's your energy like? You know, do you fall asleep in between meals? Do you feel like you have an energy slump? How do you feel when you're getting hungry? Are you able to say, okay, I'm hungry, and then say, okay, next time I stop, I can eat something? Or do you have to eat immediately because otherwise you feel like you're going to just completely fall over? Do you struggle? Yeah. Do you struggle with losing weight? If you have weight loss resistance, that more often than not can be another kind of piece to that metabolic flexibility. So that's certainly a starting point. That's my starting point to objectively, you know, kind of talk to people with a couple of questions and look objectively at labs. That's a good starting point. And acknowledging that we know the bulk of the population is not metabolically flexible. So if you're wondering, is that me? It probably is. But the good thing is that can change. That can absolutely change.
I love how positive you are, how you're willing to take a really deep look at what's not working in our culture. And your conclusions are still very hopeful. It's really great. I'm the same way. I'm like, let's look at all the poisons killing you. Isn't it great that we know about them? Now we can do something.
Well, because you know what I've learned over many years of talking to people is that if we reframe it and give people hope, then they're willing to try to make changes. But if I make it all doom and gloom, then people aren't willing to make changes because they feel like there's no hope. And so it's always my intention to keep things reframed, not so that I'm Pollyanna-ish, but that so people really genuinely are motivated. Like, isn't that what we all want? We want to motivate, inspire, educate, and empower people to make change and to be able to successfully do it and not feel overwhelmed. Because if you give people like 100 things they need to do, they're not going to be able to do that. So it's like focus on the things you can do and then, you know, make little changes from there.
The big myth that I want to tackle with you today, and you've touched on pieces of this, but I want to unpack it all the way, is that intermittent fasting is not appropriate for women.
Oh, this is my favorite because there's so much fear mongering that goes on. And I want people to really think, let this be real. Like, we would not have sustained or been able to survive as a species if women couldn't successfully fast. There were periods of feasting and periods of famine. That is a reality. If our bodies were not able to tap into fat stores for energy, we would not be here. And the other piece is, you know, when in periods of famine, sometimes women are not able to conceive. And that is done to ensure that we don't bring a baby into an environment where there isn't enough nourishment. So when people say women can't fast, I cry BS, largely because of some of the things I've already alluded to. If we know the bulk of our population, 88.2% in 2018, I'm sure it's higher now. So the study from 2018 was 88.2% of the population is not metabolically flexible. You mean to tell me that telling people to eat less often is harmful when what we really need to do is harness metabolic health? And the way to go about doing that is teaching people to eat with less meal frequency and teaching them how to appropriately put their macronutrients together, making sure they prioritize protein, making sure they prioritize non-starchy vegetables and healthy fats and fiber to keep them full. Because when we hit those satiety cues, we don't want to eat more food. And so I think it does women a tremendous disservice. The challenge is we as women are beautifully sophisticated. You know, our hormones are what make us really, really unique, especially when we're still in our cycling years and in perimenopause. And so acknowledging that we have to fast differently around our cycle. It's as simple as that. We have to fast differently if we're an athlete. We have to fast a little differently if we're in menopause. Although I would argue that women that are in menopause and men are at an advantage in some ways because they don't have as much fluctuation between estrogen and progesterone, you know, day to day. However, this does not mean that women can't fast. And I think anyone that is trying to suggest that it's insurmountable, or is basing information on lab animals, which don't have the same gestational cycle that humans do, or individuals that are basing research off of athletes. Women athletes are not the norm. I mean, if most of the population is metabolically unhealthy, you can't say, because it's detrimental to a female athlete, that means no woman can fast. I would say that if someone is training for the Olympics, or you're an elite athlete and you're a woman, absolutely, you don't want to constrain the amount of food you're eating because your body is at a different level of performance. However, I would argue that most, if not all, women that are of full maturity up until, you know, their older years, they can benefit from eating less often. And I think, you know, Sinclair, one of the things that I was saying the other day to someone was I noticed a precipitous change in my appetite as I entered my early 40s. And I said, I really think this is intuitively the way our bodies are designed to live out the rest of our years, that we are not designed to be eating all day long. We're not grazing animals. We're not herbivores. We're omnivores. Our digestive systems are sophisticated enough that we're designed to eat a meal probably every 4 to 5 hours during a specific amount of time. And then we're not meant to be eating all the time. And so I would definitely argue that to suggest that women, it's unsafe for us to fast, or it's detrimental for us to fast, I always say, look at the context. If you're pregnant or breastfeeding, if you have a disordered relationship with food, if you're underweight, no question. If you're a female athlete, probably not a great idea. If you're a really lean woman that's at your peak fertility years, you don't need to be fasting every day, but you could certainly do 12 hours of digestive rest, which is what most everyone needs to be doing. And then the fun part is when women are, you know, in those years where we can get away with fasting in certain parts of our cycle very easily, we can push the fasting windows, we can exercise with greater intensity. And then as we get closer to our menstrual cycle, less fasting. And that's okay. It's as simple as that. But it's also leaning into those lifestyle pieces that I kind of alluded to, the sleep, the stress, the nutrition, the exercise piece, because they all work together to help women determine how successful they can be. It's like pulling a lever. Like, okay, what's the lever we're pulling today? Okay, my sleep is great. My stress is dialed in. I'm not over-restricting my food. I'm not over-exercising. Then fasting is probably a good idea for me today because I'm at a point in my menstrual cycle where I can really capitalize on estrogen predominating. It really can be that methodical, and women can also be very successful. But I think it's also that same case where we talked a little bit about hormetic stress, the right amount of hormetic stress at the right time. Therefore, you know, if it's not the right time for you, going through a divorce, having had surgery, lost a bunch of weight because you have an illness or moving, it's okay to take a break. You know, it's not as if, you know, that's the one thing about fasting I think is so critically important is the flexibility and acknowledging you don't have to be rigid. Like that is one thing I've noticed about a lot of women. They thrive on rigidity. And I tell them, you need to thrive on flexibility.
God, that is the best line. We've got to pull that out and highlight it because let's make a fridge.
I just came up with that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's your new tagline or maybe the subtitle of your next book. So you've been laying out these really beautiful clues all the way along in response to this next, we'll call it a misconception, but I want to tackle it head on together because I see a lot of women experience pain. We're herd animals, right? So we, you know, we go in on something together and two friends will start intermittent fasting, two women, and one will do really well and her whole life will open up and it'll be amazing. She'll see a lot of physical changes. Her energy will go up. Her mood will stabilize. She'll get more mentally clear. And the other one might even experience a little bit of an initial success and then plateau and maybe actually see her discomfort and dysregulation increase. And then she'll give up in frustration. What do you have to say about that? Where it's like, well, it only works for some women or, you know, just I tried it and it didn't work for me. What would your response be?
Limiting beliefs.
Yeah.
Beliefs. Yeah. So this happens with frequency. So I feel like very comfortable saying weight loss resistance is a real thing. If you get stuck, there are a variety of reasons for why that happens. In fact, I create a lot of content around this in particular because it really does happen. You've got, you know, person A loses weight effortlessly and it's changed her life and she's singing to the heavens. And then person B loses a little bit of weight and then gets stuck and gets mad. And so I have to oftentimes remind people that there's a whole lot more at play than just fasting. It can be gut health, like we're talking about. It can be hormonal dysregulation. It can be toxins you're exposed to in your environment, your food, or your personal care products. It can be because your sleep is terrible. If I can't get you to sleep through the night, I can't get you to lose weight. And that's like my standard mantra. I mean, because there's so much research on sleep. I mean, I'm constantly spouting it. You know, people are stressed out. They overexercise. You know, if a little bit of exercise is good, then I need to do CrossFit 5 days a week. I mean, I got an email the other day from a woman doing CrossFit 5 days a week. I said, you're 50 years old. What are you doing CrossFit for 5 days a week? That's bananas. So it really gets that granular. I mean, I dig really, really deep with people to figure out. And then it really becomes, let's look deeper at what's going on in your lifestyle. Let's look deeper at testing. I find for a lot of people, it's inflammatory foods like dairy. I call dairy the 5 pound dairy. I'll be darned. That's why, you know, I don't eat dairy anymore. I've gotten over that. I'm like almost done 4 years. I don't miss it at all, but I call it the 5 pound dairy. And for a lot of people, it's the gluten, it's the grain, it's the dairy, it's the alcohol. Alcohol in particular, the last 2 years have been tough on people. And that has been for many people, that's, you know, been their release valve when their kids go to bed. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to get real. You have to get real. You have to get granular. It's not sexy, but you have to open up, you know, every single lid and look underneath it and just be incredibly thorough. And then lastly, another kind of hidden thing that happens is mold. Mold is such an insidious problem. I have so many women that when they tell me we've done all the things, and then they're convinced, you know, it's never going to happen. And I always say, do you think maybe you have a mold problem at your house? No. And then we get their house tests, and sure enough, they got mold. They forgot about, oh yeah, there was a leak in the bathtub and it leaked into the ceiling. And then they got to rip out a bunch of stuff, or they, you know, they're exposed to a moldy basement. And I know this from personal experience. I'm part of that unfortunate 20% of the population that my body has this reactive, extreme reaction to mold exposure. And so, you know, when we get exposed over and over and over again, it could just be one tipping point that sets us over, but that could also be what is driving that last bit of significant inflammation. So my feeling is always, there's always a reason. We just have to figure out what it is. But if you go like the conventional route, it's, you know, you eat too much food and you don't exercise enough and you just need to eat more and you need to exercise harder. You know, it's always like this kind of what I think is kind of pedantic nonsense that I hear spouted from a lot of what I'd like to believe well-meaning practitioners. But there's always a reason. But I think it also speaks to what we initially started the conversation with, that a lot of what we're exposed to in our environment is not natural. Like, it's not natural food. It's not natural light. It's not a natural way to live. And so the farther we get away from nature and, you know, circadian biology and, you know, eating a more nutrient dense diet, the more likely we are to be exposed to things that are going to dysregulate our bodies in such a way that we're not going to be metabolically flexible. And certainly, to your point, you know, the woman who gets stuck, and I always say non-scale victories, because I try really hard to not focus on the scale. I always say, how's your clothes fit? How do you feel? What's your energy like? And they want to stay dogmatically focused on that number. And I always tell them, like, listen, the scale.
Thank you, Weight Watchers, for that trauma.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I have women that I've told them to throw their scale away or put it away. I'm like, it's not healthy. I weigh myself like once a month because I just try to go by how my clothing fits, and largely because it drives people crazy. It would make me crazy if I stepped on the scale every day, because our weight goes up by a couple pounds every day just based on hydration and what we've eaten. And I mean, so many things. And it really does us an enormous disservice as women, almost to the point that I would really like to take the weight loss industry and give them a kick in the ass, because they make billions and trillions of dollars off of convincing us that we need a product, a gimmick, a powder, a pill, or a bag that's going to somehow change our lives, when intrinsically we are capable of all of that all on our own. We don't need a gimmick. We just need to have good access to good information and make positive changes.
I completely agree. God, so many good gems, Cynthia. What an amazing interview. And I'll just close with a story to drive that last point home. Like, what, a few years ago when I got serious about my health and I was, you know, reducing my inflammation, and I'd hit like a plateau. It's like, okay, I can stand for a few minutes at a time and I can read again and write again. Great. But I still look like an apple, you know, I still look like, this was, you know, 50 pounds up from where I am now, and actually more. And I started strength training. I increased my protein. I changed the entire rhythm of how I was eating very slowly. But 3 weeks into the strength training process, my trainer wanted to, you know, take all my measurements again, and I'd lost 4 inches around my waist.
It's amazing.
But I hadn't lost a single pound.
Yeah.
And I absolutely lost it. I felt like a complete failure, even though my energy was up. You know, my body was changing in proportions. My emotions were stabilizing. It was like, wait a minute, I can have a strong body. And the number was what I started to obsess about. It's not healthy and it's not real.
No, it's not. And I think we really do a disservice to ourselves as women that we get fixated. Like, I want to weigh what I weighed when I was 18 years old. Well, no, you don't. Are you the person you were at 18? Like, I think about how I was just kind of like, when I went off to college, I was like this clueless young woman. But if I stayed fixated on that number, how destructive is that? I mean, that's not helpful to stay, you know, it's like you're staying stuck in a mentality. Like, are you the same person? No. Why would I want to be that, you know, again? And I think a lot of women just get a number stuck in their heads and that's what they want to be. But really what you want to be is strong and capable. And, you know, when you finally get back to that point where you feel like you've gained back your health, you're so grateful, so incredibly grateful. And you know, that's the most important thing we possess is our health. And I think having a healthy mindset is part of that as well.
Completely agree with you. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us today, for myth busting, for being truthful about what we actually really need, metabolic flexibility. So many good gems here. Please go and check out Cynthia's brand new book. Can you just tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's kind of exciting. This has been 3 years worth of work. I feel like I'm birthing my third child. So it's called Intermittent Fasting Transformation, IF45. And the IF45 program is my signature program that, like I said, took several years to create, really in response to a need after that talk went viral. But it's designed to be a 45-day journey. It gives you a ton of information on hormones and the things we need to look out for. And then it gives you, you know, step-by-step what you need to do to be able to successfully fast if you're in your peak fertility years, if you're in perimenopause or menopause. I have 50 delicious recipes, and I tend to lean carnivore-ish. So it's a lot of animal-based protein, but we do have some vegetarian options. I worked with an incredibly, incredibly talented chef, Beth Lipton, who I think is one of the best chefs in the whole industry. And she created all the recipes for the book. It gives you all of my best tips and tricks and methodology for how to successfully fast as a female and to stop the fear mongering. Like, I just feel like we need to start a movement to, you know, stop with the patriarchy. I'm the only female in my house. Let me be clear. Like, when I say that, it says a lot. I don't want women to believe that they cannot successfully fast. I want them to have a resource. I want them to feel empowered. And really, that's what this book is. It's my gift to women so that they feel like they can be inspired to live their best lives.
Oh, so good. And I've gotten to read part of it and I can't wait to read the rest.
So. I'm so glad that you have it.
Thank you so much for joining us today. What a pleasure. Thanks for listening. Go to detoxrejuvenation.com to find the links in the show notes to everything we covered in this episode. Please subscribe, review, and share with other humans who need this precious information. Let's help each other. Until next time, love, Sinclair.